Welcome back to Engineering is Fun, You Should Try It, by Patrick Lettenmeyer, edited by Holly Jones, and narrated by Jack Talbot.
You too can leave a legacy at Gonzaga just like Mr. Lettenmeyer. Explore your options at gonzaga.edu/plannedgiving today.
In the mid-1960s, my wife and I were the parents of two girls and two boys who regularly attended school and made good grades. I was steadily employed and my wife was engaged in her dream job teaching piano and organ. We moved into our new house in 1963 and seemed content with our lives when our oldest son, Dennis, started engineering classes at the University of Washington, and at the start of his second year, found lodging in a house with several other students. Dennis was active on the UW sailing team and was enlisted in the Navy ROTC when he graduated second in his class of engineers. The raging Vietnam War was seriously affecting everyone, particularly teenagers. I remember a similar situation back in 1942 when I was 17 and Germany invaded Poland. I sympathized with my teenaged daughters watching as we were not winning the Vietnam War. We had convinced our oldest daughter, Sherry, to enroll at the University of Washington when she graduated from high school. We prepaid two quarters tuition with a dorm room. All seemed well the first couple of months of the fall quarter. However, Sherry began skipping classes and embarked on a life of active war protesting. I was insulted that my daughter would be involved. Sherry disappeared into thin air. We tried to trace her. Bernice really took it hard and was insistent we find her. 4 months later, my wife found that Sherry was safe in a commune in Vermont. I knew she'd not respond to me, but she'd always been good friends with my wife, who asked Dirk, her brother, to find the commune and, hopefully, Sherry. He did, and delivered a message of forgiveness. "Sherry, come back to Seattle," Dirk pleaded on our behalf. "Re-enter UW and come out to Sunday dinner when you have time." She came back, found a room, got a part-time waitress job, and the University of Washington admitted her into the School of Nursing. She declined to come to Sunday dinners, although she did talk to her mother, who I knew was forgiving of the entire episode. As a World War II veteran with a very patriotic family background, I was more than perplexed and barely understood Sherry's position. However, I didn't argue my wife's automatic position to love and forget. I love my daughter. She did it the hard way, but her way. Our youngest son, Terry, was the most independent. He had a Seattle Times paper route in the area where we lived from the time he was 11 years old. If you wanted to have the Times delivered, you had to let Terry do it his way. The Times never fired him when he refused to deliver to your doorstep. If you didn't have a paper box, you could do without the paper if you were on Terry's route. He made good grades and had a knack for carpentry. He really liked his shop class. I was building a new house and showed him how to wire the simple light circuits and the low-voltage doorbells. He wired all the low-voltage circuits and some of the 120-volt three-wire circuits. It passed inspection. The year Terry graduated from Federal Way High School, he entered the University of Washington's School of Electrical Engineering with a dorm room and a year's tuition paid. I had purchased a rundown fiveplex in Ballard with my older son, Dennis, which we were gutting and rebuilding in our spare time. When summer rolled around, we hired Terry to work for $1 an hour. He found a room near the job site, and I lived on Dick's Hamburgers. Our youngest daughter, Ray Ann, graduated from Federal Way High School at the top of her class and promptly decided to go her own way. She had a 2-year scholarship to George Wright College in Spokane that she pitched to the wastebasket and took off for San Francisco. She and her sister Sherry had worked part-time while going to school and saved their money, so she wasn't quite broke. After a couple of weeks, she reappeared in Seattle with a home cleaning job and living in a small apartment. Finally, she decided to enroll at UW and spent 4 years with part-time cleaning jobs, occasionally coming home when starvation was close. She graduated with a degree in food science. Later, she went back to UW for a degree in nursing. Around 1964, I'd been plucked out of Boeing's preliminary design to work on the team preparing Boeing's bid to design and build the Lunar Orbiter spacecraft for Jet Propulsion Laboratories. It was in preliminary design that I met Pete Bowers, the designer of models from Flying Aces magazine, my childhood favorite. He was a design engineer working for Boeing, too. President John F. Kennedy had christened NASA's Man on the Moon as a national goal. The first step was to map the moon with a lunar orbiter spacecraft that was yet to be designed. The spacecraft would weigh around 1,000 pounds and be launched from Cape Canaveral with an Atlas booster. Boeing's proposal design team consisted of four engineers, including Howie Neff as the supervisory engineer, Walt Hoag and me as the hardware designers, and Eric, the do-everything engineer. Boeing would not propose to use JPL's previous Ranger configuration, which simplified the job. Walt would design the basic structure, and I would design the solar panel system. At the end of the first week, Howie reviewed the paper we hadn't shredded, gave us a pep talk, and confirmed that our primary competitor had locked onto the Ranger 2 solar panel configuration. It was my poker night, but my mind was filled by solar panel configurations. Suddenly, in the middle of a hand, it hit me. Fan the panels out like a deck of cards. The next day, my sketch of four panels stowed one on top of the other, each the shape of the bottom of the spacecraft, looked good, but how to deploy the four panels in that configuration was a mystery to me. I brought Walt into my confidence, and he refined his desire to not be involved with solar panels. I gained a glimmer of hope when I figured out I could hinge each panel to the structure and use a screen door actuator on each panel, with separate locks and initiators. A couple of days later, I showed Howie the scheme, and he agreed we should take a closer look at it. By the end of the week, we were certain we had a good solution to the overall spacecraft configuration. Several months later, Boeing won the competition, and we began staffing the design team. I was named lead engineer on all the stuff that moved, including the solar panels and antenna. Walt decided to stay in PD. The basic Lunar Orbiter spacecraft program was to place a large camera designed by Kodak, Golden Egg, with two side-by-side apertures into a structure that contained the electronics, anchored with a high and low gain antenna and solar panels. The camera would photograph the entire moon's surface, develop the photos in the camera, scan the photos, and transmit the photos to JPL's Earth Lab. Guiding the design to spacecraft launch stage was a road littered with obstacles. Bob Helberg was the Boeing program manager who managed to keep Boeing's design on track. During one of Helberg's Kodak meetings, I was literally dozing in the back row when the Kodak rep clearly said, "The Kodak camera must never look at the sun, lest the lenses wrap." A couple of weeks later, Howie asked me how the camera door design was coming along. "Huh? What camera door?" I blurted. "I don't remember any direction to design a camera door." Howie's reply was, "Direction sometimes comes in strange ways." The camera door design was a hinged flat piece of aluminum moved at 90 degrees open and 90 degrees closed by a stepper motor with open and closed position switches. The mock-up design worked perfectly, and we proceeded with the detailed design until Jack Minshall, the chief engineer, found that the complete spacecraft flight design weighed far more than the Atlas booster could place in the moon trajectory. We were ordered to cut the camera door weight in half and delete the door open switch. We did as ordered by designing a waffle pattern door and ditching the open switch, knowing that the lack of the door open position was a serious mistake. Chiefs will be chiefs, I thought. The new lightweight door and open and closing system was mocked up, and I recalled Dr. McGibbon's long-ago lecture about the vibrations of the Schick electric razor. We had mocked up the new lightweight door, and it worked, sort of. The door opened, but in lurches. Very quickly, we saw the problem. The door's natural structural frequency had been lowered when we carved the weight out of the design. The door's actuator and the stepper motor frequency matched the door's structural frequency. This caused the door to flutter during opening to the extent that the exact position of the door during opening was never consistent. Sometimes it was open, sometimes it wasn't. "We must stiffen the door," said Claude Williams. "The chief was sticking with the lightweight door," I reminded him. "We have to solve the problem another way." "Screwed by the chief," I thought I heard Claude mutter. It looked like an all-hands-on-deck solution would be required. Five engineers went home that night with the suggestion that we find the solution ASAP because tomorrow never comes. The next morning, five engineers and I arrived at the exact same conclusion. Change the door's frequency. We did so by replacing one of the waffle sections in the door with an aluminum plate that had about 25 loose rivets attached like a tambourine. It worked and only cost a dinky amount of weight. I told Howie about the solution, but I forgot to tell the chief. We still had no open switch. Luck might save us. Such were engineering politics. NASA watched our design like a hawk, with frequent visits from the NASA's Chief Lunar Orbiter's headquarters near Langley, Virginia. The chief was a short, balding engineer, very sharp and likable, who had taken an interest in the camera door's design exact details. We'd just completed the design of the new lightweight door, and the chief, who had learned my name, visited us in his usual fact-finding mode. I'd barely finished our discussion while standing amidst our design group when he pointedly asked me, "Does Boeing have a photograph department?" "Yes," I replied, rather stunned. "We have a very good photo lab." "Pat, I want you to visit your photo lab and have your picture taken," Then place it on the inside of the camera door. Deadly silence for a few beats was followed by a huge burst of laughter from several eavesdropping engineers. Ever after, I was frequently asked if I had my picture taken. We completed the design and fabrication of 5 lunar orbiters that mapped almost the entire moon. Claude Williams stayed with the spacecraft as the design liaison engineer. I was transferred to the commercial airplanes, 707-727 Secondary Structures Engineering Group in Renton, Washington. Several weeks later, in the very early morning, Claude called me from the Cape. The first lunar orbiter was on the launch pad, and the flight crew, during a systems check prior to launch, had lost track of the position of the camera door.
"Jack, we told you so," I just couldn't help blurting out.
After some time on the phone, Claude agreed with me that we could use a hand-counting procedure to find the lost position of the door. Count the stepper motor blips on a paper trace. Claude did it and found the door position without taking the shroud off the launch rocket. The first launch and flight was nearly perfect, as were the 5 lunar orbiters that mapped the moon. A few years after the moon landings, I was in Washington, D.C. and visited the Aeronautics and Space Museum where the spare lunar orbiter resides. I almost teared up when I showed my wife Bernice the actual lunar orbiter. Engineering is fun. You should try it. 20. In 1968, I had been transferred to the Boeing Commercial Airplane Division as the engineer in charge of the Boeing 707 and 727 airplane secondary structure design. Secondary structure includes the landing gear, doors, flaps, and empennage. I had not worked on the original design of the 707 or 727 and was unfamiliar with the detailed design of every little part of these airplanes. I worked for Jarvis Wallen and Dudley "Dud" Nichols, the 707 and 727 chief engineer. I knew both from the XB-52 days. The first few weeks, I was swamped, learning all the details of the two airplanes. My group was in the middle of designing a wingtip in-flight refueling system and a jet-assisted takeoff system for a South American airline that flew out of La Paz, Bolivia. Early one morning, Dud's secretary summoned me to an ongoing meeting. She told me that Dud had an Air Force general on the line who was at that moment flying a KC-135, 707 tanker, out of Anchorage, Alaska, with the nose landing gear stuck in the retracted position. I remembered that the KC and 707 used the same nose landing gear lockup as the XB-52 wingtip gear. The squawk box in Dud's office was on, and I heard the general insist that he thought that the nose gear tires were somehow jammed up into the nose gear wheel well. "The KC nose gear-up lock is the same as the XB-52 tip gear-up lock," I whispered to Dud on the side. The general rambled on, suggesting he shoot the nose gear tires to deflate them, a hilarious suggestion that had Dud motion to us to tamp down our reactions. The general didn't shoot the tires, and the plane skidded to a safe landing. We had the gear pieces ready the next day and found the up-lock strut mechanism was jammed closed. Inside, a small metal link had broken into 2 pieces. I had previously designed that link for the XB-52 many years ago. The drawing still had my name in the signature block. Our lab declared the link failed because a machine part had been substituted for a forged part. A few months later, my boss Jarvis Wallen told me, "Pack your bags, you're assigned to the brain drain team." The team consisted of myself, an electrical engineer, and a tooling engineer, headed by a personal supervisor. The job was to go to Paris, Bremen, London, and Stockholm, and hire a lot of engineers. I'd never been to Europe before, although my wife had stopped as a kid in 1938 on her way from India. Quickly, I reviewed the itinerary with Bernice, and we decided she could arrange to meet me in about a month in London. I'd take a week off, and we'd go together up to Scotland. I didn't say a word to Jarvis or Bob, the trip supervisor. Paris in April was beautiful and green. All the buildings were gleaming white, and the weather was fully spring. My suite was on the second floor of the Champs-Élysées, with a direct view of the Arc de Triomphe. Each of us had a suite with a living room, boudoir, and bath. We began interviewing potential engineers the next day. Bob set up a sorting system and had some local help in sifting the applications. At that time, Algeria had declared independence from France, and a flood of French were returning from Algeria, including several engineers. France was on hard times, so the franc was peddled on the streets at exchange rates well under the official rate. At every corner of the Champs, a fellow whispered, "Change?" and readily exchanged francs for dollars at about a 25% gain. I quickly learned the game. My first morning interview was an Algerian couple. I'd noticed on the application that they were French Algerians, but my first look said they were French. When I met the couple, the girl flung her arms around my neck and asked to be saved in true Hollywood style. She spoke English. Her husband did not. He was an artist, not an engineer. They were on their last legs and needed a job, any place, even in America. We were not able to hire him. When Friday night rolled around, Bob suggested we grab dinner and then hit the Crazy Horse Cabaret. It was my first ever Parisian nightclub experience, complete with well-organized dancing girls and champagne. I grabbed a cab home.
"Monsieur Patrick," the doorman asked upon my return, "did you have a good time?"
"Oui, merci, Jacques. Et tu?" After a week, we were off to see what the Germans had to offer in Bremen. Our headquarters were in a fancy hotel on a small lake. My suite was very unlike my Paris digs. It was all new with Teutonic framed pictures and American-style drapes. The war rubble was missing. At the time, the Russians had segregated East Germany and half of Berlin from Western Germany. We were told not to ever hire any East Germans because it was impossible to distinguish Russians from Germans. Hiring was quite brisk, with plenty of engineers. I interviewed one German engineer who was well qualified and admitted he was from Berlin. He had somehow climbed over the Berlin Wall. We could not offer him a job, which resulted in his lecture to me that only the best come over the wall. Food for thought. Late one evening, I had an appointment with a group of five German engineers. They arrived in a black Mercedes limousine, all dressed in black, wearing white shirts, ties, black polished shoes, and were taking direction from one spokesman. When they entered the interview room, they all lined up military style, bowed, and clicked their heels. I almost choked trying to keep from laughing. Although they each were qualified, they insist being hired as a group, and that I could not do. It was an interesting evening, with a cold beer later. The last Bremen dinner was special, with all the glitter the hotel staff had. Our tooling engineer was a teetotaler who had problems with both French and German food. Nothing on the menus ever suited him, even on this special night. Dinner came to the dessert phase, and our tool engineer finally agreed to a dessert of cookies and ice cream. The dishes were cleared, and our conversations pleasant, when a line of servers formally entered the dining room in line. The first had a tray of four wine glasses, next four dishes of ice cream, next a bottle of brandy, and last a large tray with a cookie in the shape of a four-engine airplane. The airplane platter was placed on the table, the bottle of brandy poured over the airplane, and the brandy torched. Boeing had been shot down in flames. We howled in laughter. Our time in Bremen was through, and the next morning we thought we would be off to Stockholm, but Bob said we'd do London first. We arrived in London the next morning, and without any communication from her in the past month, I wondered if my wife might just show up. Miraculously, the hotel desk clerk had a dated note reading, "I'm at the Claridge Hotel. Love, Bernice." She was just four blocks away, so I called and walked down. There she was, with a great smile and story to tell. She'd left Seattle the week before deciding to see Amsterdam, and then skip over to London to meet some British friends she'd known in India. We were to have dinner the next evening as guests of her friends at the Royal Albert Concert Hall, just across the Thames. I told Bob that my wife was in town, and I was having her move into my suite. The desk clerk thought some hanky-panky was about, and had Bernice taken to my suite on the service elevator without registering her. Bernice thought it was hilarious that she had been taken to the suite on the service elevator without signing in at the desk. I'm sure she told her friends of that incident later. We were met the next evening by Bernice's friend, Mr. Westlake, from India, in the hotel lobby. I was underdressed in a plain suit, tie, and white shirt. Mr. Westlake was a true British gentleman, complete with a black suit, white shirt, tie, bowler hat, and umbrella. He hailed the cab by stepping off the curb, pointing the umbrella, and gently saying, "Taxi." We traveled together to the Royal Albert across the Thames. Dinner was proper English, and the concert a Russian violinist that Bernice didn't recognize. Interestingly, Mr. Westlake had been a colonel in the British Army who had been sacked for marrying an Indian princess. He and his family now lived near Farnborough, south of London. A British district collector was real upper crust in India, and also the tax collector. It was a very prodigious job that was nothing like an IRS employee. Mr. Westlake was an Oxford New College grad. The Swedes canceled our visas and our job was over. I asked Bob to tell my boss Jarvis that I would be a week late getting home. We discovered accidentally the following morning as we strolled toward Buckingham Palace that it was the Queen's birthday. The sidewalk along the street leading to the palace was three deep on each side, roped off to allow the parade through. It was a parade for the ages. Totally spectacular, from the Queen in her horse-drawn carriage to the multiple British military units. Completely different from an American parade. The British loved their military with the gaudy uniforms and medals. We thoroughly enjoyed the Queen's birthday. The following morning, we caught the train to Edinburgh, found a room and private home, and toured for a few days. After spending 5 weeks away, it was time to go home. It felt great to be back in Seattle, to see our kids, and the good old US of A. The trip taught me to trust my wife's travel abilities. During the next few years, Boeing had me in France, Germany, and London many times. Two-day trips to London once a month were common, all on Boeing's Amex card. I never again met any of the many engineers I had hired. However, over the years, I worked with many engineers hired during the Great Brain Drain. I always wished them happy times in their job and their new country. It's fun to be an engineer. 21. In late 1969, the very last thing I wanted for Christmas was a 707 Series 720 airplane. However, there it was on our Boeing field hangar, all mine, but with a Federal Aviation Administration NX sign plastered over the main entry. Airplanes designated NX are experimental and cannot be flown except by a designated flight test crew. The airplane was owned by Western Airlines and had been involved in an incident during takeoff at Phoenix. At the time, I was the engineering manager of the 707 Secondary Structures Group, so it was probably my part of the airplane that caused the problem. The pilot reported that the airplane, during completion of its takeoff climb, had suddenly pitched down and galloped several times before he managed to return the plane to level flight. A passenger with a loose seatbelt had been injured when he hit the cabin ceiling, while the other passengers had the thrill of their lives. Western contacted Boeing about the incident because the pilot claimed that this very airplane had done the same roller coaster maneuver a couple of weeks earlier. The pilot insisted that the design was faulty or something in the flight control system had failed. My boss Jarvis Wallen suggested I have a talk with Paul Higgins, the chief of Boeing Aerodynamics, who had been brought on board. He had talked to Western and the FAA. The logical thing was to let Boeing solve the problem. Western and the FAA agreed, and the plane was flown from Phoenix by a Boeing flight test crew and lodged in a Boeing field hangar. I did talk to Paul, who gave me a short lesson in aerodynamic design. He clearly thought the pilot's driving manner had initiated the roller coaster ride by chasing the stick, which meant he was moving the control column back and forth out of sequence with the airplane's up and down movements. Paul's guys had looked at the 720's instrumental initial flight test results that showed the airplane could be induced to gallop when leveling off after a climb. However, it would be a clear pilot error. Paul was off to Hawaii on vacation, laughing as he presented me the airplane as a Christmas gift. A team of mechanics on a 24-hour shift disassembled the flaps and empennage from the airplane, laying the parts on the hangar floor. I checked everything along with our shop inspectors. The FAA guy also had a look. The only thing out of the ordinary we found was that the flap's balance panel forward's edge had been lubricated. Not serious, just a minor no-no. The FAA guy agreed the inspection of the airplane showed no mechanical or structural reason for its gallop. The next step was to instrument the airplane and record an induced gallop. Two racks of test electronic gear were mounted in the passenger cabin and the test flight was set for that afternoon. We weren't wasting any time on this baby. I declined to fly with the test crew, knowing the airplane was going to be thoroughly wrung out, which it was. One of our instrumentation rack supports was bent, a reminder that the flight crew had put the airplane through some maneuvers that truly stressed the importance of fastened seatbelts in flight. After the data was checked, the analysis came in. The pilot had chased the stick. 2 days before Christmas, Western had their airplane back, less the NX sticker. Good riddance to my Christmas gift. Paul came back from his Hawaiian vacation with a great tan and satisfied grin. Western was happy to have their airplane back, and the FAA was at their sullen best. I have no idea what happened to that pilot. 22. Jet Propulsion Laboratories asked Boeing to design and build the Mariner 10 spacecraft that would fly past Mercury, orbit the Sun, fly past Venus, pass by Mercury and the Sun again, and then finish its tour with continued loops of the Sun. The flight was launched in late 1973, and Boeing began the project in late 1969. In mid-1969, I was working in Boeing's commercial airplane division when Gordon Davison from the Boeing Aerospace Company called asking me to come over and help with Boeing's competitive proposal to JPL to design and build the Mariner 10. I knew Gordy when he was a stress clerk, so I was delighted to work for him. The proposal team was made up of about 10 people, and if we won the contract, the project would have fewer than 100 engineers. It was a very small project for Boeing. The chief engineer was Ed Czarnecki, who could have passed for Donald Trump in manner and looks. He had a thunderous voice that could be heard often from his office, even with the door closed. Ed was a great leader, if your heart could stand it. My job on the proposal team was to determine the overall spacecraft configuration. After several reviews, we decided to use the basic configuration that JPL had used for their very successful Ranger spacecraft. It had an octagonal body and two rectangular deployable solar panels using the Ranger actuator design. We put the proposal together in about 3 months. During this period, Boeing was gutting their engineering force and putting our hoped-for Mariner 10 project at great risk. JPL requirements for the contract winner were to staff the project primarily with engineers who had previously worked on a spacecraft project. Unfortunately, Boeing's past spacecraft projects were few. Unbelievably, we won the proposal and signed the contract to build and launch Mariner 10 for a cool $98 million. The launch date was to be a bit over 3 years out. We set out to staff the project amidst the ongoing layoffs and cancellations of the supersonic transport design. Our personnel department had lost the 1964 roster of engineers that had worked on the lunar orbiter. However, I located and hired five, one on layoff. We needed a structural engineer manager, and I convinced my good friend Dick White to take the job. Our offices were set up in a new building at Boeing's Space Center in Auburn, Washington. Gordy had a new office with outside windows, and Dick and I shared the huge corner office across the room. Dick suggested I hire our secretary. When I reviewed the resumes of potential secretaries, I noticed that one had worked for a friend in Renton. I called Britt about the girl, and he gave her a very good grade with one remark. "She wears very short skirts," he said. "Ouch," I thought. "I better tell Dick we'll have her sit in the corner." She did wear short skirts and was an exceptionally smart secretary. Always on time and never a problem of any kind. All the guys liked her, and I never heard an unprofessional word about her skirts. Our next step was to meet with JPL and make certain we would manage the job in their strange way. JPL management system divided the spacecraft project into groups headed by Cognizant Work Unit Engineer. Each COGWUE was graded monthly by the JPL counterpart. I was the COGWUE for basic spacecraft configuration and everything that moved on the spacecraft after launch. Dick was the COGWUE of the spacecraft structure and the packaging of everything inside the structure. My JPL counterpart was Dan Cubley, a UCLA mechanical engineer. He graded me every month for 3 years, and I never knew my grades. Dick's JPL counterpart was a structures engineer who got along well with Dick. We had smooth operating systems throughout the 3 year design period. JPL was like a university of engineers building and flying spacecraft together. They were quite fun to work with. Boeing's contract of $98 million had a sizable performance bonus, of which we received near 100%. I thought I was an A student. We had three design calamities, two in my area, unbeknownst to me. NASA had a practice of soliciting ideas from the intelligentsia community for stuff to put on spacecraft, and then finding a spacecraft that was going the right place. A professor working for Goddard had an experiment using magnetometers that must be deployed several meters beyond any part of the in-flight spacecraft with a frequency of the total deployed system higher than 10 Hz. NASA dropped this job on us when we were about a year into the detailed design of the spacecraft. When I met the professor in his office at Goddard, I was certain I had met the ultimate mad scientist. We designed the twin-section deployable 1-inch diameter boom of graphite epoxy and made it in our Boeing lab. It was great fun for our lab to build a boom of epoxy impregnated graphite cloth. We made two, and the mess in the lab looked like we made many more. I'll never forget the fun project with the mad professor and the kettle of epoxy. One nice calm day, Gordy appeared in the office doorway. "We forgot the low-gain antenna," he said. We had no idea the spacecraft even needed a low-gain antenna, and it hadn't been mentioned in the request for proposal. It became my responsibility. So I made a couple of sketches, found a place for it on the spacecraft's base structure, and asked Claude Williams to do the detailed design in 3 weeks without overtime. At that time in my career, we had draftsmen in the design group, so most of the drawings were prepared by draftsmen, which allowed the design engineers to work on more than one design at a time. Claude beat the 3 week schedule and turned out a flawless low gain antenna and the spring lock deployment system that worked out perfectly. The JPL management system had resulted in having our design engineers following their designs during fabrication and being on call by our shop during both day and night shift. Consequently, during fabrication of the magnetometer booms, Jack, the design engineer, was continually in the lab. We were barely on schedule for the lab to deliver the completed booms to the spacecraft assembly area. Late after everyone had left the office, Chief Ed and his assistant Chaim Kennett were standing in my doorway, with Ed waving a small piece of paper and wanting last-minute updates on the whereabouts of the mag boom. Miraculously, I just happened to know it was on a truck on its way to final assembly. "I've been holding up this to see if you were ever going to get that damn boom finished," Ed explained. He handed me the slip. It was a nice raise and a great confidence builder. The Mariner 10 spacecraft design project produced a near infallible spacecraft, and I'm very proud to have had a large part in its design. We built a spare spacecraft that is on display in the National Space and Aeronautics Museum in Washington, D.C. Think seriously about being an engineer. Your work, too, may be on display. Epilogue. In January 1982, I told my wife Bernice that I was going to retire in May. "Let's do it," she replied. I retired from Boeing after 33 years. My outfit threw me a retirement party. I think it was to see me off rather than good riddance. The ride was fun and my timing perfect. I made the right decision in 1933 to become an engineer. I've never regretted it once, even though my mother always thought I should run the farm. Education in my family was a first priority. My mother and father encouraged and never stood in the way of my sister and me going to college. My mother, a nurse, after retiring, went back to school and gained her bachelor's. My father used everything he learned during recuperation and became a well-respected stonemason and carpenter and built at least 5 houses by himself. My sister became a pharmacist. My 2 sons are engineering PhDs, and my 2 daughters, who are both retired, have multiple degrees in nursing. My wife was a music teacher with a bachelor's in Latin and Greek and another bachelor's in music. One of my granddaughters is an accountant with her bachelor's from Gonzaga. Her daughter, my great-granddaughter, is a student at Gonzaga Prep. I'm the low man on the totem with a bachelor's in mechanical engineering, courtesy of Dr. McGivern at Gonzaga University. Not too bad for a Spokane Valley farm kid who grew up during the Great Depression. Thank you for listening to Engineering is Fun, You Should Try It, by Patrick Lettenmeyer. It has been an honor and a privilege to learn, read, and now present Mr. Lettenmeyer's story to you. We truly hope you enjoyed it.